My name is Leo Morgan. I'm a writer-photographer. This is April 7th, 1980. I've just finished duplicating tapes I made over the years of Howard Rock. I want to get them safely in storage, and I think an introduction is due. A little history as I know it. I met Howard in 1965 when I was working as a reporter for the Juno Empire. I took a trip to Skagway in the late fall and met Howard walking the streets of Skagway. The town was basically empty, so we noticed each other. It was the only vacation I knew him to take until his retirement. The museum was closed, and some citizens said they'd open it for me, got a key, and I went in and found Howard there. We didn't talk to each other because we were both very reserved with strangers. He stuck to his side of the room and I stuck to mine. He had a sketchbook. He was doing some sketching. In the process of looking, I broke an artifact. I was horrified. And finally, I spoke to Howard and told him of my chagrin. He came over and fixed the artifact very handily. And I was very much in his debt, kind of bailed me out with the people of Skagway. We ran into each other for another couple of days, and I saw him later in the Juneau Airport. I'd heard a little bit about the paper, but I didn't know very much about it. I wrote my first article for him the following year, 1966. I interviewed the last basket, last Chilkoot blanket maker in Yakutat. Or, no, it wasn't Yakutat. It was Clark 1, and did a story for him on that. And then in 1966, I went to Fairbanks looking for work and thought maybe I'd get a job with Rock, not knowing how little money the paper had. He said he couldn't afford to hire me unless I wanted to pay my way selling advertising, so I went to work for the Fairbanks News Miner. But I continued to send him articles on the sly over the years. For no money, and especially when I was covering legislature, I began to see the Bush Bloc forming, and I began to do stories from him there, without byline, quite often because my boss was not too happy about my extracurricular. I went to work from the News Miner to Jessen's Weekly, continued to do little things for Howard. And then in 1968, I went outside and eventually got a job on the LA Times. I stayed there until 1977, and I could see the land, 1971, I could see the land claims was moving right along and that Howard needed a hand. So I talked the LA Times into giving me a four-month leave of absence. I arrived there to discover, to my horror, that Howard had fired his one reporter in order to put me on the payroll. Arrived in the late spring, lived miserably in an apartment, a cramped little apartment, and salary was very low, but we couldn't pay the postage bill quite often, so I didn't feel too badly about it. I knew it was going to be tough working for Howard. My friend Sheila Turner had done so in 1968 while she worked for me, and she said, no matter how hard you worked for him, you never felt you were doing enough. He never said he liked anything. He never said he didn't like anything, and you always felt guilty for not putting in quite enough time. At the end of that year, I was a basket case, although we'd done some really good stories. I was just worn out. The Times, in the meantime, had told me I had to come back or I would be fired, short of the leave they had promised me. I didn't feel like leaving Howard in the lurch, so I told them to shove it. And when I got back in the fall, the Times would not hire me back. The land claims I knew we were going to be settled. I didn't think there was any particular job for me. But then I began to wonder what would happen with the transition. And ultimately, using the Tundra Times as my sponsor, I got an Alicia Patterson Foundation grant to go and live a month in each village with each different group of natives. The work that I did on this project was made into newsletters, which Alicia Patterson sent nationwide, and the Tundra Times also used my material. So Howard had a reporter free for that year. I traveled the bush before, but never really lived there. And my first stop was Anaktuvuk Pass in February. Howard was very worried about me. He didn't like my synthetic clothes. He said if I didn't have fur, the natives would worry about me. I couldn't afford fur. I tested all my Arctic gear in Fairbanks, and he was very doubtful. He loaned me a beautiful pair of fur mittens that I think Ruth had made him, and figured at least if I died, my hands would be preserved. One of the last things he told me before I went to Anaktuvuk was that a lemming might try to get into my sleeping bag in the middle of the night, and to let him that they didn't take up much room. Anaktuvuk was hard, but I found my own way, and came back a rather hardened bush traveler. It was 50 below, 50 mile an hour winds. From there, I went to Point Hope, thinking that it would be a snap, because I was going to live with Howard's sister, Ruth. Howard had just been nominated Man of the Year, and we'd gone to the banquet. He didn't win, but he got the biggest ovation of anybody there. And I'd brought a tape of it, which the first thing I did was I played it to Ruth Nash and her husband, Bernard. They listened to this, and they were absolutely amazed. They said, why are these people clapping for Howard? I discovered to my chagrin that they didn't like Howard, that they felt that he was stingy, that he was rich because he always wore a suit, and yet he never sent any money home. They didn't feel he'd given his parents enough support. They didn't understand him. They didn't like him because he didn't hunt whales. They had absolutely no idea that he'd sacrificed a career in art for the land claims movement for his people. They put up with me because they were duty-bound as relatives to do so. That year they threw every other white person off the ice, except me and John Boxtos, who'd been there 11 years, and I figured I'd be next to go, but they tolerated me. In later years, Ruth Nash became my friend. But that was really hard trekking. I would have done better, I discovered, had I gone not mentioning Howard at all. One thing, I had heard Howard had been married from other natives, and I wanted to find out about it. That was the first question his relatives asked me. Do you know anything about Howard's wife? I had to say no. They knew very little about him. He talked very seldom about his personal life. Howard and I were both very reserved. We grew closer in 72. He'd always go to Tommy's elbow room, take his table, and if you were lonesome, you knew you could sit down and not talk to Howard. You could sit at his table for hours, and he wouldn't talk to you unless you wanted to talk. It was good for us loners to have a spot like that. One time I came in from Galena. I'd had a really terrific visit in Galena. I was very happy. And I sat down with Howard, and Ruby Tansey was there. She was very militant in those days and didn't like me, and was very nasty to me. And to my absolute astonishment, Howard tersely defended me. It was the first time I suspected that he might really be on my side. One day, towards the end, I guess about the last year he was alive, I got excited and embraced him and kissed him on the cheek, and he was absolutely astonished. He told Laura Burke, Lael actually kissed me. We were two very reticent people, but we did grow very close. In 1973, after my Alicia Patterson grant was through, the claims were well settled, and I went back to work for the LA Times. They finally took me back and quit the Newark. Howard got very sick at that point. He retired, went to Hawaii to die. But when he saw how Tom Richards Jr. was running the paper, a good writer, a fine photographer, but really no business experience, He decided he couldn't afford to die, and he came screaming back from Hawaii. At that point, John Sackett had the management of the paper, and he called me and asked me to come up to work for Howard for a few weeks. I was broke. I'd quit the Times and had no job in sight. The last thing I needed was another few free weeks at the Tundra Times, but I knew John was right, so I went up. Howard was very frail. He was only working a couple of hours a day at that point, very weak when I first got there. Actually, the paper was as well staffed as I'd ever seen it. I couldn't figure out why they'd asked me. But I noticed that Howard always brightened when I was around, and we began spending more time in Tommy's, more time in the office, talking about old times, talking about the future, looking ahead. And within a week, he was working full days. I guess he just really needed somebody to talk to. And he gained remarkable strength. In the year and a half ahead, he pulled the paper from the red into the black as solidly as it had ever been. In the spring of 1974, I was working for Alaska Magazine, and Howard wanted to go to the Whaling Festival in Point Hope. I've never liked the Whaling Festival because there's so many tourists, but he was very, very much wanted to go back, wanted to go home. So we went together. He'd forgotten his Eskimo, something that really embarrassed him. Indeed, I was more fluent than he was at that point, although we could understand. We stayed at Ruth and Burnett's, and he made his peace with them. They had finally come to understand, as had the village, what he'd done for them, what he tried to do for them, and how much he really loved the village, even though he wasn't a whale hunter like Allen or Brulick. He had caught perhaps the biggest whale of all. It was very hard going in his family at first. I felt like a referee. But towards the end, it was a great peace made. It was a very nice time. I continued to moonlight for Howard over the years, working for the Alaska Magazine. And in 1976, he wrote me and said that he had a Ford Foundation grant I was going to take to study bilingual education. And he was going to pay half, and Ford was going to pay the other half. I said, Howard, you can't afford to pay half my salary. And he said, no, I know that. You're going to take a cut. We got the grant. I talked them into letting me stay 1 month in Alaska, and then the other two outside, studying bilingual. Howard knew he was dying. That's why he asked me to come. He wanted a little company. He seemed pretty strong. Yeah, I went out to St. Lawrence Island for a couple of weeks, and when I came back, he looked frail. But he insisted I go to Barrow. The morning I came back from St. Lawrence, the girls called me and said, was I coming in? And I said, yes. And they said, Howard is very, very frail. I walked into the office, into his office, and I thought, I'd seen his brother Brulick, who had a stroke, who was a tiny little old man. And I thought, what's a Brulick doing in here? And then I looked again and realized it was Howard. He'd just simply come apart. The chemotherapy had just all of a sudden let him down. And he was a helpless, drawn little old man. His mind was still very good. And it was Tuesday, and that was the paper deadline. Oh, wait, it was a Monday, and he said he wanted to stay at the paper until we got it out. So he did. I spent most of the day just talking to him. He sat at his desk, and we talked until about 6 at night. I wanted to help him home to the Northwood building, but he said no, he wanted to stay for a while. I thought perhaps he might want to kill himself. And I was afraid he couldn't get home alone, but I left him. I guess the hardest thing I ever did was walk out of that office. He did stay for a while, and then somehow he got himself back to the Northwood building, and the next morning I picked him up at the Northwood. Hard time getting him awake, and a hard time getting him to come down. He didn't want to go to the hospital. But the paper was out, and he did go. And he insisted that I go to Barrow. I didn't want to go to Barrow. I didn't think there was much of a story in bilingual up there, but he insisted. And I went, found there was one hell of a story, two of them, as a matter of fact, because I met the Japanese that is just finishing his trip from over the North Pole with his dog team, which I copyrighted. When I got back, Howard wanted his lawyer. No one would get him, and his lawyer was basically in Juneau, but Barry Jackson could have done the job, but Barry couldn't be gotten. By the time we got the lawyers there, it was too late. Howard had wanted to change his will. He had written a second will cutting Tom Richards Jr. out of the paper, the original will, named Tom as a major stockholder. He couldn't bring himself to sign the second will. It was in his desk. He loved Tom like a son, as close to a son as he'd ever had, and yet he was worried about his financial management abilities. In his last hours, he had wanted to sign, but nobody had gotten the lawyers, and so the initial will stood, the second will unsigned. He lingered for a couple of days, unconscious, basically, unable to talk to us, unable to recognize him, and died in the morning. Tom Richards Jr. was with him and called me. It was a really hard time. We held a memorial service in Fairbanks. All the native leaders were in Juneau. They were trying to hitch a ride on a Teamster plane free to come back for the funeral and didn't make it and didn't want to travel commercial. The only native leader who went to the funeral or the initial memorial service was Joe Wilkinson. And Joe also went to Point Hope for the final ceremony of the burial. Joe and Howard had been at odds for the better part of the land claims, and Joe, about a year and a half before Howard had died, had made his peace with Howard in a very nice way. I much admired the way he handled the situation. The funeral at Point Hope was very cold. The men had dug all night in the hard ground. Graves there are very shallow. We went up with a coffin, Tom Richards did, and I came later after we got the paper to bed. And all the obituaries written. It was a good service. Donald Talick, the reindeer herder, turned Episcopal minister, read the service and did a good job of it. Howard had told me years ago that, pointed out to me the grave of Anton Gorick, a powerful witch doctor in Point Hope, in his grandfather's time. Howard told me he wanted to be buried there, apart from the Episcopal Cemetery. I thought he would have said something about it in his will. He did not. I had to convince his sister, Helen, and Chester Civic, his brother-in-law. They were very much into the church, and they had to give it a lot of thought. But they finally allowed Howard to be buried off by himself. It was a funny thing working at the Tundra Times. Whenever we were broke, which was most of the time, sometimes we couldn't pay the postage bill. Sometimes the typesetting machine would break down, or the secretary or the typesetter would quit, or a reporter would quit. Whenever this would happen, Howard never seemed to be particularly worried. Some wonderful thing would come out of the sky. We'd get a better secretary. Money would come from nowhere, a big ad, a donation. Always seemed to save us. And as years went by, I began to think that Howard might be a bit of a witch doctor himself. He never seemed to be worried. He always seemed to know that we were going to get bailed out. Maybe he just knew right was on his side. But I don't think it unfitting that he be buried next to Atan Gorak, where he wanted to go. The tape on the other side, the other side of this tape, is very noisy. It was made in the Tiki Cove with Tom Snapp and Howard Rock in 1972 when I wanted to write a newsletter and a history of the Tundra Times. I'd heard them talk several times about their founding and decided to get it on tape. Neither of them were amenable to sitting in the sterile old office, and that's why the background is so noisy. But somehow it seems fitting that we have a little clutter and the clink of glasses. Over the years, I've tried to fill in the holes in Howard's history. There are a lot of them. I have one tape missing, which I can't find now, which I didn't get transcribed, that he made, when he told me he married the daughter of a missionary, I think one who had been up at Elam. She loved a horseback ride, and Howard didn't. They lived apparently in Seattle. I have no date on this, and I'm still tracking. He was a good friend of C. Allen Johnson. I'm headed up there now to see what C. Allen can put together. I was in White Mountain a few years back, staying at the home of an old-timer, and I said, "Oh, you must have known Howard Rock." And he said, "That son of a bitch married my daughter." Apparently, the marriage didn't last. And he said of his daughter, "She was a butterfly. She was a butterfly." Howard never spoke of it. His greatest love, apparently, was the lady in Tangiers. And there were a couple in later life, but that one stood out. And we'll hope we'll catch up with that lady one of these days. I'm trying to gather clips from the Tundra Times. Howard wanted to do a book. He'd promised an agent in New York, Marie Rodell, that he would do one. We put together a few things. Marie died before he did. But they didn't like his writing, which really hurt. That's when he called me in to see if I could work with him on it. They didn't like my rewriting of his writing either, so the material stood. And when we get around to do it, when we finally had the time away from the pressure of the paper, Howard was too weak. He died, by the way, with about $16,000 ahead in the checking account. It was all gone within 6 months, and the paper was in debt again. But he did bring it by very nobly. The other two tapes were made in 1974, when Howard was still terribly weak, the period when Johnny Sackett asked me to sit the office. I'm committing them to the library because I believe that more than any one person, Howard Rock helped weld the native groups together. And perhaps there would have been a land claims had he not had his Tundra Times, but it would have been very difficult. When we started the movement, I don't believe any of us ever figured we'd see it in our own time. It sort of grew like Topsy. He was wonderful to work for. He had a terrific news sense. And as you'll see on the tapes, he tempered both myself and Tom Snapp, who often got overzealous. He tried very hard to be fair, to balance, to not let his emotions take over, and to be objective. He served as a referee, a cool head, in the middle of the fighting. I've seen him get mad, but I never saw him get out of control. And it doesn't say on the tapes here, but I think we should know, the future generation should remember Howard Rock. I know of no human who came such a terrific span from basic subsistence hunting to a point where he was fluent enough to write in another language and manage a newspaper. He covered a tremendous hunk of history. To the very end, he was an artist. They asked him to do a final painting for an auction, to get the tundra tines out of the red, and he did it. It was totally different from his other style, much freer and lovely. One day he was flying from Anchorage to Fairbanks and saw Mount McKinley about 6 months before his death. It struck him. It was beautiful. The mountain was really lovely, he said. And then later, when he was home in the Northwood building watching his television, he saw the same thing on the screen, as real as if it was light. It puzzled him. In his heart, he was always an artist. And I don't think he regretted giving up something he loved that much for something he loved a little bit more. But it was not easy. There's been a void in my life and lots of lives since he went. But I was happy to know that a couple of years ago, Dorcas Rock had a sixth baby against doctor's advice. Dorcas is Elijah's wife, and Elijah was an adopted son of one of the Rock boys. Interestingly enough, for all that huge family, they left no male heirs bearing the name of Rock. And when Dorcas and Elijah had their last son, they named him Howard Rock. It's an old Eskimo tradition to name a new baby after a spirit that's missed. And it's a good feeling to know there's another Howard Rock on the horizon. A new baby after a departed spirit.
I haven't. It was closed when I left this last fall to go out to California.
But you'd really enjoy it. It's, and we'll be going up there and beginning early May with some early promotional trips with the travel agents and the press and the industry people. We'll be taking them up there and spend the night at the hotel. It's going to be an interesting promotion.
I think so. Well,
because, you see, the highway is up on the ridges. The train more or less follows the canyon.
Will you still have some snow at that time of year up there?
Well, there won't be too much. In early June, you'll still find snow, of course, in the higher passes. And, of course, it can snow any time up there in the park when you get up to 3,000-4,000 feet.
As I recall, some people were skiing on the glaciers in the summertime around here via helicopters.
Does that
still go on?
Oh, yeah.
How does that work?
Well, you fly from, actually, Girdwood or Portage up to Carpathian, which is up in the Chugach range.
How do you spell that?
Carpathian.
Who's in charge of that? Where could I get some information on that particular trip?
Call Alyeska Air Service. They do that now, of course, too.
Uh-huh.
Call 277-5002.
Who would be a good person to talk to?
George Crow would be the one to talk to.
Okay. Very good. Well, I'll drop by your office tomorrow and pick up that folder. And if you think of any more weird ones, like the people wanting to spend Christmas at Barrow, I'd sure be interested.
Well, let me think about that. Of course, you always have this situation anywhere in the world. Wherever you have military people, you have a lot of people come up here to visit family. And this, of course, means a lot of travel that comes up here that maybe sometimes we don't even get involved with it. But car rentals are interesting. We'll get people come in here and pick up a car and drive out somewhere and get stuck with it. it's an exciting adventure for them, for these people from California, to come up here and experience this contrast of climate.
A common thing from this office, someone out of the legal department would have to make any comments that were to be made. I have been told that we are going to join, and that's all I know. And the exact basis on what it's all about, I'm not real sure. I would suggest that you contact Mobil, probably it'd be or BP would be my guess, would be who have legal counsel here in town, would probably be your best bet.
Can tell me if the suit has been filed?
No, because I don't know. I honestly, at this point, I don't see how it could have been, because I had heard that they were talking. I heard about it on Friday afternoon, that they were still trying to make up their minds whether or not they would try to use this approach or administrative, I guess. And to my knowledge, the courts were closed on Monday, and certainly they couldn't have done anything on Friday, so I would have to assume negative at this point, that they, it has not been. But since all offices were closed yesterday in the state system, I'm sure it couldn't have been done then.
Okay, well, I appreciate you.
I'm giving this to you strictly as individual, and I don't have any official position because I just haven't been told.
Okay.
When we were just chatting with AEC, and I began to worry about what would happen to the village if something went wrong. When these devices were exploding, you know, he came more and more disenchanted with his job, and so he, well, became outspoken and was eventually fired.
They still remember his wife as a lady who could sew mukluks better than some of the natives. And somebody told me, Otelek told me he bought a pair from her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, she was like, she went right in and so with the women up there.
And he went out. How. He went out on the whale hunts.
Yeah,
and
whale
he worked
hunts.
With them.
He took and he went fishing, like for whaling in the fall and things, and got his share, you know. They lived
it was
like the folks up there.
And it was his writing, his research was the first time that I got a very full appreciation of the native subsistence culture. You know,
I only got that 2 weeks ago. I have no idea. Even in Point Hope, I had no idea how important.
I was, coming from outside. You know, I would be more would probably have attended it that when I first came to sort of discounted that. You know,
yeah. Who could live like that?
And but then he had all this detailed information that he'd gotten, like. I was very impressed because he took all the different animals that they took, and he had a detailed breakdown of when they took them, you know, and how much those hides were worth. And he figured it all up, and if he figured up the cost of all the animals they took for clothing, you know, and the food that they got, and he gave it a numerical value, and so much $1 a pound for whale meat or what it was.
Yeah.
And it would mean that they were making an equivalent of something like $15,000 or $20,000 a year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, oh my land, well maybe this is not, I've got to take another look at that, because I was under the impression that subsistence economy, they were not making well, it was, you know, I was saying it was a very low monetary amount.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it was things like that that the research turned up.
Really bold man and a creative scientist.
Yeah, it was too bad that he, and a young man. When he
I
died,
wonder where he is. Did he die?
He died
in an automobile accident here on campus.
Jeez. Right here in Fairfax. He was, he and Jim Babb. You know Jim Babb, I mean, and that's why they were riding in this car, and it was slippery, and they lost control of the car, and they were hit by a car, and was killed.
There was a number, back during this time, there was a number of real sort of tragic things that happened with the Howard.
Yeah.
One was when Miss Madigan, who had come and during this early period, had come from time to time, and she fell off of a horse and died. She was riding. Do you remember this?
I was going to ask that because I would see her referred to as a lady, you know.
Well, this whole story is quite a story, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is.
It's really more to it than I thought it was. Sort of hard to say it. Laid out and everything. Start a paper that is like when we started our paper, you know, the last week it, we were on it for about 2 or 3 months. But this one was just something like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew we was going to have to get this a tremendous amount, and it also was in the middle of the political season. And we had to get those ads, and we were having to run all day on ads. We were having to go from one politician's
did
office.
Did you and
to
Howard get the ads?
Oh, yeah.
We both went together. That was the deal. We were sticking together just like that. We did for that whole year almost. What? Everywhere I went, that was the deal. See, because I knew that if you were just right, the one-to-one relationship, you know, you just right with him. Couldn't help but get quite a bit out of it. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be just like, well, I think he got a journalism education out of that year where you would, you know, a lot more than it. He'd have to go maybe 2 or 3 years.
Oh my God, his judgment now is, you know, so fantastic. I get really teed off with him sometimes, and then it comes up like last week and saves my neck. Because his judgment is so damn good, you know.
Well, I disregarded all of it. I said, no, we're just going to sit down and write. And we talked about what he knew. And he started telling me about all these things that he was very, the cultural deals, you know. We were very proud of an Eskimo culture. You know, he started telling me all these fantastic things like, for instance, like, you know, to go to the supermarket, now we have all these plastic bags to wrap everything in. Well, he said, well, we've had those for centuries. I said, we've had that. It was, what it was guts, you know, that they clean out, testing, and they make boats out of them. They make boats out of them, and they put those salmon berries and those, and they put fish, and they put all kinds of things in those boats, and they store them down in their cellars. And so, in effect, what he was saying was that they had, when you go to the supermarket, you see all that convenience of that frozen food. They've been having that frozen food like that for centuries.
Yeah.
And he was telling how that they used that same skin to make raincoats, and that they had raincoats way before we had raincoats, you know, the Western culture. In other words, he was telling all about, oh, and I said, oh, that righted up. Oh, that's good, you know, that was. And so I really encouraged him, and he started writing all those things.
My favorite article out of that first year is one that's titled Don't Sweat. Do you remember that one? Did you write that one, Howard?
No,
Don't Sweat the Arctic. I'd kind of, if I was going to make a coat of arms for the Arctic, that would be my title.
You see, the old people train their young men in such a way that, you know, that's why they, you know, they're rugged, and they're muscular, you know, maybe due to their rugged games they play all the time, and, you know, certain times of the year. You know, their endurance is very, spectacular.
Could I have some coffee?
And, therefore, they can make quite a bit of exertion without really sweating. They couldn't discourage sweating up there because, you know, when you sweat, well, when you start cooling off, well, you might cool off too quickly, and we're in trouble.
Yeah. I thought that was a tremendous philosophical article for the Tundra Times at that period, too. You must have done your share of sweating. Did you have to worry about bills in the beginning?
No, we didn't, did we?
No, we didn't have to worry too much about that. Because we were, you know, Dr. Forbes was furnishing the money for us to publish.
Although, we had to pay a tremendous amount for that printing. For 24 issues, once every 2 weeks, Jasmine charged $28,000 for the printing. The same back in Kentucky when I was editor 2 years for 32 issues, a year, and we paid $3,000 for the printer. And up here, it was, for less issues, it was $28,000. You know, it was just cost much. But they did. All we had to do was fix the dummy. They set the type, we got it back, and we reprinted it. We turned it back and they corrected it. And then they did do the makeup, you know, that's their makeup. So they didn't do, I mean, like, we do more on our paper now than they did. I mean, than what we did then.
Yeah, so do we.
Yeah, they do now. I mean, Howard does now. But
how would you describe Howard as a writer when he first started?
Well, I thought it was, he had a natural knack for writing. He had a natural knack for writing. It wouldn't have worked with just an ordinary person. And, you know, he had a background, an art background. And he had an appreciation of humanities, what I call humanities. It's, you know, for cultural things. You know, like on his language, he had a real strong appreciation. In fact, way back at the very first, he was pressing that he needed to have bilingual field, which are just now starting, and he all along here. And on things of preserving the good aspects of a culture, and at the same time adopting the things about the oncoming culture and meshing the two into a side of a whole, you know, which I thought was very good. Now, if you didn't have someone with that background, I mean, his writing, he also had this, well, a rich background which he could write about, was all within him.
Well, you meshed two cultures yourself. You've been brought up in a traditional way, although you had to wear those store-bought shoes, I hear.
Oh, yes.
Freeze your feet. But you also had a good broad run it outside.
Well, he had... he had an appreciation of both cultures. I think that anyone who studies art has got to have an appreciation of, other cultures. Other cultures, too. Not only it was,
they can be made to work pretty well together, I believe, in compatibility of the two countries is there. That's why we are able to combine, use certain things with their culture and make them work together.
I mean, he had a lot of things that was within him in his writing that was different, opposite from mine. For instance, in his writing style, he'd write editorials. I use overstatements. That's my modus operandi. He uses understatement.
Yeah.
Well,
his editorial on that Cosby thing would have been the most natural thing in the world to write an editorial about that subject. He wrote an editorial about that subject, but it wasn't about that subject at all, you know. It was the sneakiest damn editorial I ever read.
He had a number of different editorials that was more effective than one I could write, because I would write overstatement, which people would react negatively to, maybe, or a lot of people would. And he would write an understatement.
Were you ever tempted to tamper with that talk?
No. I mean, I could recognize that if you read it, you could recognize how effective it was. So I thought it was beautiful, you know.
So long. We need to go over his editorials when you wrote the editorials, you know. And I tell Tom, I think you can state this a little different way.
It's the damnedest combination I could imagine.
He would go over my editorials. And see, I was overstating. And he would tone mine down, and I would go over his, trying to tone his up, you know, trying to make his stronger sometimes, you know. But anyway, it worked out fine.
Well, how was your personal life? Did you have any time to do anything on the side, either of you?
When we first started, we had to go 24-hour state. We had to go all night long. We had to go all night long.
Because we had to. We had to meet this deadline for the first mission. Worked all night long.
For a number of days, maybe we'd go 2 or 3 days and then we'd sleep one night.
And you find you could both do that. You were living together in order to put out the first one at Colleen's. So.
No, we weren't living together.
He was living at the Nordale.
Yeah, I was living at the Nordale at that time.
Where were you living, Charles?
Where was I living then? I think I was living at the trailer. Wasn't I living at the trailer?
Yeah, you was living at the trailer.
I was living at the trailer, and he was living at the Nordale. But then, see, it's got a great big living room and kitchen combined.
No, the sugar's right there. Somebody was looking for the sugar, I thought.
Oh, right.
And
so close you couldn't even see it.
I know.
We did fix our meals there.
Tom did the cooking. They also did the dishwashing, and there was a canary, you know, that kept flying into the dishwasher.
Well, we had the canary, and he insisted on putting the canary out to let it fly about. And that canary would fly in that dishwasher, and it almost drowned one day. And we were getting... working on that deal where we sometimes if we didn't clean up the mess, you know, we're getting jelly all over the coffee. Those people, Larry Loomis and them over at Jess, they start to put their coffee down and get jelly all over the laptop machine. They said, where is this jelly come from?
How long did you stay with the paper?
I only stayed that 1 year. One year was up. I was determined that I wasn't going to be this deal. I worked real hard to get Howard prepared that 1 year, and I thought, well, that's it. Then the 1 year, and he said, as soon as that 1 year was up, that was it. That was it. I went.
How'd you tell him you decided to stay in the first place? What made you decide to stay?
Well, when Dr. Forbes indicated that he would back the paper to the tune of, I forgot what it was, so many $1,000 the first year. Well, then I knew it was feasible.
$6,000.
Was it?
How much was it?
$6,000.
$6,000? Six?
The first year.
Just six? Oh.
Yeah. Wasn't it more than $6,000? Was it more than
$6,000? Well, I think we started out getting things ready. We buying some things and all that, you know. But then for the initial issue, I believe he...
It was $6,000 for the initial issue, but I think he said he guaranteed up to $25,000 or $35,000 or something the first year.
Mm-hmm.
That it was depending on how much we would need. Now, we didn't need all that at first. Now, I think it was $6,000 what we started with. But later on, we had to ask for it because we had to put the printing deal cost much.
Yeah. Were you getting charged more than other people in Fairbanks because you were native paper, or was it just...
We got all kind of stuff we ran into along the way, one of which was that MUS asking a much larger deposit because none of the corporators, this Howard and Alfred Kessler, Martha Tielick. They didn't have a credit reference. And because those incorporators or the owners didn't have a credit reference, they made us pay a huge deposit. I forget what it was now. I was very angry over that.
$200.
And then I got on the phone and was making a long distance call, and the call cost more than $100. And when the call reached $100, that operator broke in. No, she waited till after we got off. She waited till after we got off of the line, and then she told us that we had to come down and pay the bill at once in the middle of the night, which I didn't like at all. And I queried other people, and they said that they didn't do that to anybody else. And I tried to explain to them that we had this money in the bank, we had a grant, and that we were solvent, and it wasn't actually was a lot, they could have trusted us a lot better than they could somebody else, because we did have the funds to pay it, you know. They were just...
You see, starting in Native paper, that time was a very rough one, because we were distressed, against us, you know, and there were whisperings against us, which kept us down a great deal, but it's the same, kept going.
There was all kind of this pressure where people were saying, I took quite a lot of that abuse myself on that reservations bit. They said that what we were trying to do was we were do-gooders trying to put the natives on reservations, like in the lower states. And you know, that would be the furthest from what anyone would want to do, to put them on a poverty-stricken reservation. Yeah. But, and it was a bit on the land claims. In other words, they transferred, in fact, Sneddon did his editorials. That's what he was doing. He was saying that we were pressing for the land claims. What they were doing was pressing for reservations. That's what it was amounting to. That was one of our biggest problems.
By the time I got here on the staff full time, I simply, you know, I had a hell of a summer last summer, because a lot of people I thought were my friends in Fairbanks were hysterical about the native situation and the other situation. And they simply said that I was against all the white people and I'd gone, you know, to the other side. And I didn't know there were two sides. I thought we were all one side against the United States. It didn't.
Well, yeah, supposedly you are, but then a lot of people don't interpret it that way.
And you must have gotten a bit of that guff too.
Oh, yeah, when we first started, it was out of this world. It was all uphill. And we helped, we got into all kind of deals. We got in this deal where we were the ones that caused the land freeze.
Single-handed? I mean, double-handed you and Howard?
It wasn't it. What is that?
The land freeze. I said,
oh, yeah.
See, what happened was, Bible for these leases between Nina and Armenta. And immediately upon filing for them, all these people, businessmen, creditors, filed for the ground for them. And they started filing just early, you know, and they started filing right up to them. And then the state got word that here were these people were going to get all this oil. So they started making and they went right up to the to Mentos boundary. Right up to the boundary, all around. Then they went down the street in Mentos. Well, then they started to come after them and go down. And they wanted to file a bill. The protest was soon for some kind of big old deal. Because you couldn't tell that time. And you didn't know how to file what to put them on all the BLM land records. They never had any information like that. So people would go out to file and they would look on the land records and it would be shown that there was no claim there. Then they'd go out and file for it. And the state was filing for it. Because all these patents that they had been filing for 5 years as the Bureau of Indians, they had filed them in their safes down in Juneau, and they worked in D.C., which is in the archives, and they worked it on the status records where they should be. And so, so we had to try to think of some method whereby they couldn't put on the land records, and that's what we were doing.
One guy in BLM that ever had any sympathy with you got fired over the World's Fair deal, apparently.
Yeah, right. That was a little bit later. But that was during that time. But anyway, we found out that the method would be to file a protest, which would probably be dismissed here locally, but it would be appealed. And they called it, they said, to make a Native Rights Assertion.
How much help did you get from the Indian Affairs? theirs on this, the association. Did they help in some of this figuring, or
not
did they kind of leave you on your own once you got...
They left us on our own. But I'll tell you who we did get as the attorney and who filed the papers was Ted Stevens. And he filed... We started getting... What was so confusing was... In the past, from time to time, those groups had made out their claims. And they had different claims. I mean, they had one claim, and it was smaller than the other one. And the next time, they'd have a bigger one. And then sometimes they'd come back, and the boundaries were different. So then it became a problem of which one for them to file. Which map did you go by? Did you go by the one they had in 1930-some, or the one in 1952, or what? So anyway, we had a lot of problems over that. Then their maps were too crude. They were drawn out, you know, according to rivers and so forth, and they didn't... You had to get these huge maps. We had to buy huge maps.
What all those maps are doing on the top shelf.
Those are the maps.
When did I been wrestling with those things?
We had to send them out to the villages. And then they had to have a meeting. They had to compare their deal to what they had, and they had to draw it out on that line. Then all that had to be put in legal language. And that's where Ted Stevens come in, because, you know, that's... But he had been with the Interior Department, and he knew how to draw the paper up. So then he drew the papers up to protest, and we filed the first one. And we had to go down to Nenana. I remember we met those people on that Butana boat.
Yeah.
And we sent them a bush plane to try to get them fixed. And they had to be notarized and all that stuff. And then, so they were filed. The first one was filed. And as soon as the first one was filed, there was two more came in. They were even bigger. It was Northway with a huge assertion area. Then Tanacross, and there was a huge assertion area. And so then we fixed out the deals with them. We had to fix these overlays. We had to get plastic and fix the overlay over the top and draw the overlay. Well, anyway,
they should be in the museum.
They really should be, yeah. I didn't realize you guys engineered all that trouble. No wonder they said you caused the land freeze. You did.
Well, what they did was they first had to first, they, that caused, that was a freeze, but it wasn't a full freeze. It was a freeze on,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
On just a state.
When you all came here to our banquet, you put on the deep freeze.
That was a big one.
What year was that? That was, I remember that. That was 67. 68, yeah.
See, they first had the first freeze, which was just against state deep. Then they had another, they increased it, and they made it against all selection in those areas. And in the meantime, as soon as those three was filed, they started filing them all over the state, didn't they?
Yeah. You know,
and just every which way. So pretty soon the state was just blanketed. And then when the state was practically blanketed, then Udall came in and he made a super famous all over the state.
When did Nenana come in? What year was that?
That was, I believe it was 1961 or 62, maybe. 62, because
yeah.
That's 62, that's when we started, October 62, and was that year. But it took us a while. It took us about 63 before we got them through, because it wasn't simple. And
I get it.
But they promptly denied them. When they first put them in, they dismissed them and said it was not right. And they had to be appealed. And that took more papers. We filed those. And then when it got to the headman in Washington, D.C., the Secretary of Interior, he kept it for a long time before making a decision, didn't he?
Yep.
People were wondering what on earth was going to happen. And then he came out with a decision. That's how it happened. Well, now I got a lot of guff after that, you know, about people saying that we had no right to stop development in Alaska and all that stuff. And it has been bad, you know, to have this on. But
what's his face? Who's the guy that's been holding us up on the land claims thing? The old guy told us when we went to statehood this was going to happen if we didn't sell the claims. And he was right.
Well, is this the kind of stuff that you want?
Yeah.
You see, Tom and myself, I think we speeded up our land claims work a great deal.
You never could have gotten that stuff published in any paper. Even if you'd had all the time and money and lawyers in the world, you couldn't have gotten it published.
It did, and it took a lot of lot of nerve, really.
Did you ever have any personal threats? Or, you know, there were times this summer when I expected a bomb to come in that front door.
Yeah, well, you know, we have had things like that, you know, things falling through the door at night and like that sort of stuff. And I've been threatened with beatings and things like that, you know. But somehow we just kept right on going.
What I really took offense at was that the head of that Bureau of Commercial Fisheries, or that guy from the communist.
Kubilov's deal was a rough one for us. We were stepping on big toes, you know, well, because we were stepping on big toes quite a bit all right along, you know, but they were stepping right back in this one.
That was the Bureau of Commercial Fisheries?
Yes. Balso was the main character in that one.
Well, that's what I mean.
Anyway, when that paper started, you know what they sent out from a newsman? They sent over word that they would give us 6 weeks. Give it down to 6 weeks. That's what they did on the newsroom. We were ahead of you going because. Announcement going how many years?
We'll have like 10.